it's Diane. On my mind, the Tuskegee study 50 years later. This week marks 5 decades since an AP journalist broke the story about a government project that came to symbolize medical racism in America. Doctors let syphilis go untreated in hundreds of black men without their knowledge. Since then, researchers have pointed to Tuskegee as a central cause of mistrust between black Americans and medical institutions, resulting in poor health outcomes and even a decrease in life expectancy among black men. My guest today is Evelyn Hammonds. She's an expert on the intersection of race and disease. She says Tuskegee is only part of a much longer story that explains health inequities in America. Professor Hammonds, can you outline for us the details of the Tuskegee study? Who was involved? What did researchers say they were trying to do?
Sure, happy to do so. So this is a study that was begun in 1932 by the United States Public Health Service. And it was initially called Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Negro Male, and is now referred to as the United States Public Health Service Syphilis Study at Tuskegee. And so just to make one note about that, a lot of people sort of flip to a shorthand and just say the Tuskegee study. But I think that's not a great shorthand to use, in part because it puts the onus on Tuskegee rather than emphasizing this was a United States Public Health Service study. So that's where the onus should be, because they initiated the study at Tuskegee Institute, which is in Tuskegee, Alabama. The study initially involved about 600 Black men, some, I think, about 400 with syphilis, and then there were about 200 who did not have the disease. So that's how the study was established. There was no informed consent of the men. They were told by the leaders of the study that they were being examined because they had indicated that they had bad blood, in quotes. And that was a euphemism for syphilis that they thought the men would understand in their sort of condescending manner. They did not feel that they needed to explain in any detail the disease. The question that these researchers were trying to understand is whether the study would show that the long-term effects of syphilis were different in African Americans than it was in whites. There had been a previous study in Oslo that suggested some late-term syphilis issues that some researchers thought were interesting, and they wanted to use this group of Black men to get at that question. So it began in 1932. In 1972, there was an Associated Press story, as you know, about the study was published. And as a result, it came to much broader public attention by the Health and Human Services Division of the United States government.
Can you help me understand where these men came from? Were they volunteers? Were they recruited? If so, how? How did they get into this study?
It's a combination of volunteering and being recruited. These were mostly poor African-American men who lived in the areas around Tuskegee Institute. This is was a very poor area. They had very, very little access to healthcare. And so they knew that they were, you know, they had some kind of illness. And so it was presented to them that they would be getting some test and some help for the way they felt. So, you know, health checkups and perhaps some help, some treatment for their particular ailments. And so they were told this was a study to come to help them, you know, sort of get some medical attention and perhaps medical treatment and to be followed over a long period of time.
Were they actually paid to be part of this study?
No, they were not paid to be part of the study. Subsequently, as the study proceeded, and the researchers wanted to follow those men to the times of their deaths and actually perform autopsies, the Commonwealth Fund provided some funding to offer them burial assistance to encourage the families of these men to allow the autopsies, but they were not paid in any kind of a regular stipend by the Public Health Service.
Did any of the men actually know they had syphilis?
It's hard to know if any of the individual men actually knew something about syphilis. The colloquial term bad blood was the one that was emphasized. And, you know, that's just sort of a catch-all term that kind of included issues related to anemia, fatigue. And, you know, these men, when they came in for their checkups, they received, you know, free medical exams, free meals, and then, of course, this final burial insurance. So it's hard to say if they actually knew that it was syphilis. These were not, you know, well-educated folks. But, you know, I think one of the questions that I've always found interesting about this, that part of the story is the historian Susan Reverby, who I think is one of the, you know, best historians on this study, noted that sometimes the wives of some of these men would say, you know, why can't I go and find out and get some of these exams? Because I don't feel well either. And the wives were, you know, kind of discouraged to press that point.
How were the men actually treated? What were they given?
Well, it's hard to determine if they were actually given very much of any kind of medicine. They were examined. They may have been given some things like aspirin, as I recall, but not very much more than that, because that would have compromised the study in the sense that they wanted to understand untreated syphilis.
Didn't some researchers raise questions?
So 1932 to 1972 is a long time.
Yes.
And so I would say at the beginning, it's not clear that many people actually in the Public Health Service thought that there were any questions to be raised, because that was a time when ideas about differences in diseases based on race were very common. And so researchers thought there was a great deal of syphilis in Tuskegee, in the area around Tuskegee in Macon County. And they thought, well, let's see if it's different for Black people. And that was not considered a uncomfortable question or a out of bounds question to ask on the part of white researchers. So they weren't, it wasn't surprising to them. Oh, and I should also add that the reports of the study were published in journals that many of the researchers in the Public Health Service would have read. So it didn't raise any flags for anybody at the beginning.
But
over the time, though, there were some researchers who began to say, what exactly is going on with this study? And one of the reasons that the study came to public attention in 1972 is that, you know, the people who raised it coming out of the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, would say, what is this study? Why do we keep reading about it? What are the questions that are supposed to be under study? And there was an advisory panel that was established by the Assistant Secretary for Health and Scientific Affairs. And they reviewed the study, and the advisory panel concluded that the study was, quote unquote, ethically unjustified, that the results were pretty meager to have, you know, sort of bring these men in every year to be examined. And so there were real questions raised at that time. So in October 1972, the advisory panel reviewing it advised that the study be stopped.
I gather in 1966, it was one Peter Buxton, a Public Health Service investigator, who raised concerns about the study and then leaked the information to an AP reporter who published the research and said it was a woman named Jean Heller who called it one of the grossest violations of human rights I can imagine. And that's in 1972, as you say, when the story about the experiment appeared on the front page of the New York Times.
Right.
I wonder what kind of reaction that story got.
Well, it garnered a great deal of attention, which is why the federal government immediately had to look into the study and see what was going on. As I said, it's not that it was a secret study that people didn't know about. It's just that the questions were, as I said at the beginning of it, were questions that were people were comfortable asking about racial differences in disease. And so it didn't raise any flags. And so it took much longer, that is by 1966, as you just noted, for some researchers to start saying, this is not right. This is something extremely problematic. People knew that the men were not informed of why they were being examined. Some of them were given spinal taps. They didn't know what was happening. And so people began to say, wait a minute, this is definitely deserves review and needs to be revealed. And the other thing some historians have also made note of is that while the sort of idea of people being enrolled in clinical studies like this, we now, you have to get informed consent from participants. Back at that time, that was not the usual practice. At the same time, as I was about to say, historians have raised the question, well, there is the Hippocratic Oath. There is a first do no harm. Everybody knew that. And so they should have been willing to step out and examine what was happening in this study based on that, as much as we would now have some formal informed consent practices.
To what extent, if you know, was harm done to these men in the process of this study?
So I believe the harm is it involves a number of things. First is that the men were not told that they had syphilis. They were encouraged not to seek out any other medical help. So if they needed anything else, they were encouraged just, you know, you're in the study, so we're taking care of you. And they weren't being taken care of at all. And so the deceit, the deception that they experienced did indeed cause harm. They thought they were getting help. They were coming in fairly, you know, on a regular basis, and they were not getting help. And I think the perception that you turn to medical practitioners because they will help you was totally damaged. We don't know how they were treated for, you know, other things that came up and in their lives over this long period of time. So I do think that it is a major harm because just as we will get to talking about today, trust between a patient and their medical practitioner is the foundation of getting people appropriate and serious healthcare. This trust was broken. This trust was broken in this study.
Are there other examples of this kind of thinking about race and disease that occurred during that period?
Well, I would argue, certainly my work, and my work begins in the middle of the 19th century. And I always begin with saying to my students that, you know, the very idea that Black bodies were different than white bodies is something that was very prominent in medical practice, certainly under slavery. the idea that Black people didn't experience pain the same ways as white people did. And that very idea is something that persisted in medical education for a very long time. And in the 20th century, then you have Black people who will go into emergency rooms or go in to be treated for things, and they were being under-medicated because of that widespread belief, false belief, that Black people experience pain differently than white people, that Black bodies are different than white bodies and inferior to white bodies as well in many of the perceptions of physicians. And generations of white physicians, and all physicians, were trained with these kinds of notions. And certainly by the early 20th century, African-American physicians, social scientists began to question that very idea. Were mortality rates for Black people so terribly higher than for white people because of racial differences, or did it have to do with social conditions that Black people had to live under? So if you're talking about that it's a racial difference, then you don't have to do anything because you say, hey, you know, Black bodies are different than white bodies and this is what we expect. But if it's due to social conditions, then you do have to consider where people work, whether they have adequate food, what kind of housing do they live in, what kind of sanitation is available to them. Those things are not racial questions. Those are social questions. And so these very ideas have a very long legacy, the idea of racial differences in disease.
That came up in the beginning of the COVID crisis.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did, because it's such a prevalent belief. And so in COVID, when rates of COVID started showing, it appeared that they were higher in African-American communities and also in some Latinx communities, people immediately said it's something about race, rather than the social conditions under which people lived, that a lot of Black and brown peoples were working in jobs that put them in greater contact with the virus, low-level workers in hospitals, public transportation drivers, all these kinds of folks who were being around and in places where the virus, they could not be protected from exposure to the virus. And therefore, those are the kinds of things that we don't ask those questions in the United States if the default answer is always going to be it's a racial difference. And that means there's some fundamental inherent bodily difference that produces these differences in mortality rates. And as a historian of medicine and American science, that idea really turns our attention away from social conditions, access to healthcare issues, too few people of color in the medical profession. Those kinds of questions get deflected because it's so easy to just believe, well, Black people die at higher rates from certain diseases because they're Black.
Now, does that go back to the Tuskegee experiments, or was it there even before?
My argument is that it was there before. And though the study does indeed become a very striking and important episode in the history of American medicine. But as I said, the ideas that led to the Public Health Service establishing the study and keeping it going for so long are much older than the study itself.
Much older than the study itself. But what would you say are the lessons of the Tuskegee studies?
So I think that the lessons of the study are that when we think of populations of people in America as vulnerable populations, we need to be much more careful about the kinds of assumptions we make about why they are vulnerable, right? Instead of thinking about the social structure and the social determinants of health, we turn to these old ideas about bodily differences. And we also ignore, at our peril, the ways in which episodes like the Tuskegee study do point to distrust and do create and reveal the longstanding distrust that many people of color who have lived in populations that have not received the healthcare that they need or deserve feel toward medicine itself. And that once people want to step back from getting the healthcare they need, or in the case of infectious diseases, engage in practices that are going to protect themselves, their families, and their neighbors, then we're in trouble.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Evelyn Hammond, professor of history of science and African American studies at Harvard's T. Chan School of Public Health. What about the influx of people of color into the medical profession itself? Has that changed the attitudes of African Americans?
So certainly there are studies that show when African Americans have Black medical practitioners, that there is increased trust and an increased willingness to go and see those people for healthcare. Because as I want to emphasize here, there are studies that are now showing that the fact that many African Americans have heard about the Tuskegee study, that in and of itself has produced this mistrust of Black people of the white medical establishment, if you will. But I would argue that this episode reveals that, but many, many African Americans had a great deal of mistrust of the medical system before Tuskegee and after Tuskegee, because they experienced the direct impact of negative attitudes toward them by white professionals on a regular basis. And as my father, before he passed away, was fond of saying, it's not Tuskegee that bothers me, it's the way that doctor treated me last week.
So was that doctor a white doctor?
Yes.
Or a Black doctor?
A white doctor. And so is the treatment by the overwhelming majority of medical practitioners, certainly doctors in this country are white. And if these pervasive negative attitudes really produce and help sustain notions and feelings of mistrust on the part of African Americans toward medical practitioners, not all of them, but some of them who do not seem to deeply care about giving them the best care.
So how can we overcome those feelings? How can the medical profession itself behave in a different way that would incur greater trust?
So I think what is happening right now, certainly in the wake of the death of George Floyd, there's a great deal of attention to on the part of medical leaders in this country, both at the highest reaches like the National Academy of Medicine and also across the country at various medical schools, to review their curricula, begin to say we need to train doctors to address systemic racism in medicine in the United States, and begin to also teach medical students to not carry into the next generation these unfounded ideas about racial differences that lead to subpar care of African American peoples in this country. And so I think the changes in medical education, the push by medical leadership to say we have to do better, we can't have a large proportion of our population mistrusting us, not trusting us, and we therefore the medical establishment has to become more trustworthy. And I think there are many efforts underway right now to try to do that, and we'll see how that pans out.
Give me an example of how doctors can behave in a more trustworthy fashion.
So I think one of the common features that I've noticed both personally and professionally is how many African Americans say, I go in to see my doctor and they don't listen to me. They just don't listen to me. I tried to tell them that I'm feeling really terrible and it's for this, and you know, various reasons, and they don't listen to me. They seem to assume that they understand what's happening for me, but they are not paying attention. And so I think that absence of attention gets slowly but surely turned into mistrust. And so I think for what has to change in medical practice, it's for white physicians to understand they need to listen to their patients. And they, especially their Black patients, and that goes across class lines. It really, I think it's fundamentally an issue of interactions that revolve around notions of race that lead some white practitioners to discount the lived experience and the evidence that Black patients bring to them. That dismissal is what has to stop.
Of course, I've heard so many white women say the same
similar things. Absolutely.
Doctors just don't listen. But it seems as though African Americans feel and continue to feel they are at a specific disadvantage with the medical profession, which continues to engender that mistrust.
Yes, and as I said, the fact that there are too few Black and Brown practitioners is one thing. That there seems to be quite serious lapses in communication and understanding. All of those things need to change in order for people to feel that they can trust their physicians. Now, of course, if you had a different kind of social scientist on the show, they would give you the data on very serious studies that point to some of these issues. But as a historian, I'm interested very much in the narratives and how people perceive their experience in medical encounters, and how those perceptions have persisted over time. And in my reading of the history, there are so many times when African Americans have come forward to say, you know, this system needs to change. First, we need better access to healthcare. We need more healthcare. We need more practitioners who are Black and Brown and who are considered. And we also need people who are deeply committed to our care. And of course, all those things are possible.
Has the presence of COVID created that much more mistrust African Americans or among the minority who've received the vaccine? Is that part of this mistrust?
Oh, of course, it's part of the mistrust. And certainly, you know, as efforts have began to spring up around the distribution of COVID vaccines, it was very clear to African-American practitioners that they needed to get voices out into communities that people would listen to, Black people would listen to and say, okay, now that, you know, Reverend whoever says that getting a vaccine is good, I'm going to pay attention to this. And meanwhile, other kinds of communications that were being, you know, pushed into various communities didn't make sense to people. They were skeptical. But also, if you want people to trust you, as I said, you have to be trustworthy. You have to make vaccines available in places where people can easily get them. If I've got to take two buses to get to the vaccine, I'm not going to take two buses to get to the vaccine, right? And get my vaccinations. But you want to put the distribution of vaccines in communities of color, then that's when people will turn to it. You put people out there who are providing the vaccines, who will talk to those people and assure them that vaccines will be helpful to them, then you're going to get a better response. And that's one of the things that to do it.
Do you regard this as a hopeful moment or not?
I think it's a hopeful moment because of the attention that the problems that the COVID pandemic has revealed. Those problems have been longstanding, but the focus on them at this point from, as I said, the highest reaches of the medical establishment all the way to public health departments in various cities and counties, the fact that people are now paying attention is hopeful to me, because then once we start paying attention, we really need to address a lot of issues. And I think people are beginning to do so. Whether we will get to the heart of the matter and really deal with the ways in which some of the social determinants, poor housing, lack of access to healthcare, and those things become more evident, whether we're going to change is another question. But at least now, nobody can walk around saying they don't know anything about these things.
Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say?
So for me, this moment is especially important and noteworthy because as someone who's studied the American medical system and race since the 1850s, to see the kinds of people who are really willing to now say that we really have to address systemic and structural issues in American medicine so that we are providing the best healthcare for the entire population is unambiguously, in my mind, a hopeful moment.
Professor Hammond, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
That was Edlyn Hammond, professor of history of science and African American studies at Harvard's T. Chan School of Public Health. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.